Hey, David, what's going on?
Not much, just recording
Our
this Bitcoin roundup.
first podcast in a long time. We used to do these. So we used to do podcasts, and then we started doing Twitter spaces, and then we started turning our Twitter spaces into podcasts. And we posted those. Those did okay. We decided to go back to like a true podcast format. So that's what this is. We're just going to be recording ourselves just once a week, going through the Bitcoin Roundup newsletter. So, for those that don't know, so we're from Coinbits. Coinbits is, we think, the best user experience for getting onto Bitcoin and then using it day to day as an on-ramp. We're expanding our feature set to be a lot more banking oriented. So, in the short term here, you're going to be able to start using Coinbits every day for banking. And we're really excited for that. And so part of what we're doing here is just restarting the podcast, making sure that our name is back out there. And David also works for Coinbits. I'm on the product side. David works on marketing and BD. And we make a lot of cool content together, so we thought we'd try this. What we thought we'd do with this is we already write this newsletter. So we have a newsletter called Bitcoin Roundup, which is a little play on words because we have a roundups feature in Coinbits where you round up your spare change. So we thought, why don't we round up the news and call it Bitcoin Roundup Newsletter? So you could get that newsletter at newsletter.coinbits.app. So newsletter.coinbits.app. And then there you can subscribe to the newsletter, which I really hope everyone does. We put really a lot of heart and soul into that newsletter, and it really helps us. Like, we do it for our own sake in a way. We talk about the news. We need to kind of orient ourselves to trends and what's happening in the Bitcoin space and the macroeconomic space. And so we realize we're doing that already. Why don't we share that with the world and really help people understand Bitcoin? So that's the point of the newsletter. It's to be your Bitcoin guide, and comes out every week on Thursdays. And so this podcast is just going to kind of go over a lot of the topics and data points and news stories that we put in the newsletter. So some people might like to read it, other people might have more time to listen. So that's what this is for. David, anything to add to that?
No, I think that's a terrific summary of what we're doing and what we hope to accomplish. And I'd love to just kick things off with reading the Bitcoin box score. It's a fun little tile that we put before the introduction of the newsletter with some key metrics in the Bitcoin ecosystem. And they are pulled from Clark Moody's Bitcoin dashboard. And so earlier today, Bitcoin surpassed $50,000, its dollar exchange rate, for the first time in. Do you know how long it's been since it was 50K?
I don't know. It was a really long time though. I mean,
Yeah.
years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, current as of this recording, it's at $49,870 for with a market cap of 978.7 billion, so almost back to that $1 trillion market cap, which it should definitely be in. That's definitely in the top 10, like, global assets by market cap.
It is. It's going to hit silver pretty soon here. It's almost a trillion, and silver's 1.2, so all the silver bugs are on notice. Actually, it's interesting too that it's bouncing off 50,000. It makes me think that there's weak hands who have set like limits on 50K to like automatically take some Bitcoin off the table. So that's probably happening. It's a psychological barrier, but once it kind of establishes itself above 50K, probably see up from there. I mean, we don't like to make price predictions, but man, Twitter has been insane with the price predictions. And there are so many people who, I mean, I would characterize these personalities as people who don't like make price predictions central to who they are. And yet they're making those predictions because they're just looking at data and saying we have a demand crunch impending,
Yeah.
and like and it's fun to spend money mentally that you don't have. And everyone likes to think about $500,000 Bitcoin, $1 million Bitcoin. We'll see, but definitely about back. Would you say we're out of the bear market? How long before we can say that?
I think that we've been out of the bear market for a few months now, but it's interesting. It's like Bitcoin's appreciation over the past year, it's been kind of like a drip campaign. So it's like we're on this drip campaign up to, like, you know, 100,000, 200,000. And I saw an interesting metric that, like, the Google searches for Bitcoin have not spiked with this, like, appreciation compared to that, like, you know, 2017 bull run, and then the 2020, like 2021, the last one. Yeah. And, you know, those were associated with a lot more Google searches. And this one, the searches have been more like constant.
Yeah, I saw that there was a spike in searches around the ETF approval, and then it dropped off precipitously, probably because as soon as people didn't see the price move dramatically, they lost interest. And that's really too bad for them. But I'm really hoping that, you know, some of the price predictions that I'm most interested in are not about the upside potential, but more about the dampening of volatility long term. So I've seen some analyses that when you have ETFs now, where you have traditional finance and people's portfolios just coming in, rebalancing their portfolios on, you know, a consistent basis, let's say they're rebalancing annually, you have, in, you know, people who are much more comfortable buying and holding and sort of sticking to some goal for the percentage of their portfolio that they wanted Bitcoin. So instead of it being like price based, it's like, I want, you know, 5% of my portfolio to be in Bitcoin. So people will go in and then make adjustments to their portfolio to hit that number, as opposed to buying and selling on a price. And, you know, some people are saying that that will really help dampen the volatility of the asset, which I think that that's a tremendous win for Bitcoin, because even if it means that there's less upside quickly in the short term, that's not what we want anyway. What we want is sustainability. We want a sustainable integration of Bitcoin with the traditional fiat system. And this achieves that. And so, you know, I'm really hopeful that the ETF is going to be really good for Bitcoin over the long term, regardless of its price.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that a lot of people make fun of those who, you know, Bitcoiners who just talk about like sharp ratios and portfolio allocations.
What's the sharp ratio? For those of you,
the sharp ratio, I'm gonna have to pull it up just to get the exact definition, but it is the like it's a measurement of basically returns like relative to risk, and okay. So you want a You would want a sharp ratio that's closer to one, if I have my math correct on that. And so a lot of people have run the math on different portfolios and have discovered that adding a Bitcoin allocation improves your sharp ratio. So in the simplest way, you could take a standard 60-40 stock bond portfolio breakdown. That's like the classic one that everybody kind of makes fun of. But you add a 1% or a 5% Bitcoin allocation, and you run the numbers historically, and that basically improves the Sharpe ratio of that portfolio. And so a lot of people have looked at that and use that to justify the retirement portfolio allocations that you were talking about. I even saw that there was some sort of Canadian, I think it was, maybe it was Fidelity. I might be getting that incorrect, but there's some sort of institutional like fund or investment company that was actually advising clients to have a Bitcoin allocation in their portfolios. So that it's getting normalized in that aspect, which is interesting.
Okay. There's another little anecdote on the normalization here, which is that people noticed that it seems that Dave Ramsey, who's one of the most popular radio shows in the United States, for those not in the United States, this guy is a juggernaut. He started a movement in middle America middle class America for getting out of debt not messing around with credit card, personal responsibility, financial hygiene. And his system really helped a lot of people. I'm a huge fan of Dave Ramsey. He's a really, I would say, on balance, he doesn't get everything right, but he's an extraordinarily positive influence on our culture. And, yeah. But he's always been very strongly opposed to Bitcoin. And I would characterize him as somebody whose system of investment. So there's the personal responsibility side, and that's all about like not getting into debt and saving and so on. That's perennial, right? That applies no matter what. Then there's the investment philosophy. And the investment philosophy was always, you know, buy some big, good growth stock mutual funds, and you're going to win in the long term, and you don't have to worry about what to invest in, really. It's a very simple system. The problem is that system hasn't been returning as it used to. So it like used to be really good advice, and now that advice doesn't really fit the situation we're in. He's always been anti-Bitcoin, I think, because, you know, part of his thing is you want financial peace. You're not going to be at peace if you're constantly looking at your portfolio and it's up 500% and down 1,000%, right? Okay. So I get that, but he's gone back now. He's back in like Bitcoin Twitter because people are noticing he's scrubbing his timeline of negative comments about Bitcoin. Yeah. So that's fascinating, right? I mean, and that correlating to what you were just talking about, that financial respected financial advisors have now started recommending.
It was Fidelity. I was able to look it up. It's Fidelity Investments Canada has incorporated a 1-3% Bitcoin allocation into its all-in-one asset allocation funds.
Wow.
So that's pretty huge.
Yeah. Amazing. All right. So that's price. What about hash rate? So as somebody who does a little bit of mining, the hash rate drives me a little nuts. How is it that all throughout this brutal bear market that was longer and harsher than almost anything that came before it in Bitcoin land, hash rate was never really significantly reduced, right? It was always increasing. It was brutal. For anybody who's in the mining business, there are two possible explanations for this, and it's probably both, I guess. And I want to run them by you, David. So one is that that it's just debt financed, that there's these people who are able to get loans. Maybe they took out huge loans back in the ZIRP era, and they're just able to sustain mining operations with loans. The other one is, with the long-term like assumption or prediction that they're just going to stockpile Bitcoin, you know, survive the bear market, and the Bitcoin that they mine that they don't have to sell to fund their operations will be worth so much that they'll be able to pay off their debts and then make a healthy profit. The other explanation I've heard, which is like a little bit more like a conspiracy theory type of a thing, but like it makes a lot of sense too, is nation states are mining at a hash rate that, you know, nobody even predicted or understands. Like there's, you know, perhaps I saw a rumor that said that that Russia, since the sanctions on them were put in place a couple of years ago, that was really the trigger for them to start mining. And I know that some nation states do mine. I think Brunei might be.
I think it was Bhutan.
Bhutan is mining. Yeah. So there are some that publicly do, and then there is the possibility that there's big ones like China and Russia, maybe the US, that are mining secretly. What do you think about those two explanations, the debt and then the nation states?
Yeah, I think those are good. I think also, you know, and I'm not a mining expert by any means, but I think there's the additional aspect of being able to turn energy that, you know, would have previously been just wasted, like stranded energy. Yeah, converting that into something. That's another kind of like subsidy almost on that market. And I think that's, you know, very positive. And I think in addition to nation states, I've read that also, like, you know, large companies like Tether that are just, you know, doing so well, have gotten involved in the mining space. So that's another consideration.
That's a good point.
And Yeah, I think that what's interesting about mining is that it's like, you know, there's regulations in one country that push it to another country. It's almost like the Bitcoin network itself. It's just like this water where it just flows to from one nation state to another, and the incentives are basically like, you know, it flows to wherever it makes sense.
Yeah. So much investment has been made in mining infrastructure in the United States after the China ban in 2021, I guess it was. And now there's an effort to go after Bitcoin miners from, I guess, the executive branch. What is this that I've seen where there's a emergency data collection initiative to assess the harm of Bitcoin mining in the United States?
Yeah, it's the Department of Energy, which is scrutinizing Bitcoin mining through like a 6-month survey where they're going to work with like observe these miners and collect various data points. And it'll likely result in like a really scary report at the end of their work that will be used as potentially some sort of justification for action against miners. And I think that one takeaway for me from this is that just in terms of actually rebutting this information, that I actually think it's curious that they're even, you know, spending time collecting this data, because these groups don't actually even care about like how much, you know, emissions these miners might be doing. I think that they just want to go after energy uses that they deem bad. It's basically like a values based argument. So, you know, and it really crystallized for me when these groups have gone after AI's energy consumption, that basically any energy consumption to these groups is basically de facto bad. And so pushing back against these groups with like facts about how, you know, green Bitcoin mining energy consumption might be, or all of the goods that it might do, I don't think that these institutions will take that seriously. And so the proper response is basically one of, you know, saying that, you know, people should be free to pay for whatever, you know, energy consumption they want to on the free market. I mean, it's interesting. Like, I think I saw Alan Farrington had a pretty funny meme about this in response to an article on Bloomberg about how it was, you know, power needs of AI are so big that coal-fired plants are being kept open to sustain them. And he said, like, hey, you got a license for that profitable energy consumption? It's like pretty, yeah, pretty crazy. It's basically like trying to just, you know, prevent people from using energy, consuming energy for profitable means. And yeah, that's what's under attack, not necessarily like Bitcoin mining. It's more nefarious than just a facts driven, persuasion driven argument. It's really that like energy consumption is bad.
Energy consumption is bad. And actually, that's right. I like what you said earlier. I just want to like underscore it, that it's really tempting when you have a prevailing narrative in the culture to try to twist it to your own purposes. And like, there's a video called This Machine Greens, which is I think produced by Swan, and it's all, yeah, about how Bitcoin mining is very green. Great. I love that video. I've shared that video with multiple people. I think it's wonderful. However, I also think that when you make those types of arguments, you're seeding the argument that technology, that energy consumption has to be like quote unquote green, which isn't even definable, right?
Yeah.
Like when you look at the, you know, total impact on the planet when comparing you know, natural gas to like solar, when you actually look at how solar impacts the planet with the strip mines that are necessary to get the minerals and production process and the upgrade schedule for them and so on, you know, it has its own problems. So you can't just say, you can't just assume what green means and then just try to play by the rules of your opponent who is using green as a cudgel, and then to say, like, to kind of give them the benefit of the doubt that they're making a good faith argument about the environmental friendliness of a certain energy use. It's you know, I think that's the wrong way to approach it. I agree with you. It's much more, I think, so some people don't like the hypocrisy angle. I like the hypocrisy angle. Some people say, like, you shouldn't talk about Christmas lights and how much they consume and so on, because really you should talk about the market and how in like a positive fashion, people choose what to spend their energy on. But I like the hypocrisy angle because it's a political tool that tends to work. And so what I would say to people who are concerned about Bitcoin mining and its consumption is, for those of you that do fly private, stop right away. That's an inexcusable, hypocritical move that is only about your personal comfort and convenience, to like such a, the reward, like the fact of the luxury and the contrast between how luxurious your flights are to how much you're polluting the earth by making that choice is so extreme that it is absolutely, there's no defense to that. Stop flying private. And for those of you who don't fly private, great. But then now it's on you to also, it's incumbent on you to become an activist against private flights, because otherwise you're also a hypocrite, because you're pointing out one thing and not the other thing. And the other thing is a lot more, it's not market driven by, you know, the invisible hand with like millions of people deciding how to spend their energy. It's one person deciding that their leg room and, you know, the level of their comfort for the next 2 or 3 hours is worth polluting more than many people will do in a lifetime. So I think that we need to get a lot more aggressive with pointing out hypocrisy when people come after Bitcoin mining. It's actually all just because they don't like Bitcoin, because Bitcoin represents an exit from the system. I think Hillary Clinton said recently, she said something about how like Bitcoin's dangerous because it competes with the US dollar. And then Obama said that he doesn't like Bitcoin because it's like having a Swiss bank account in your pocket. And I was like, what an amazing, like, that's the best referral we could ever get, right? Obama saying it's like having a Swiss bank account in your pocket. Yes, let's do that. I want a Swiss bank account. I think everybody should have one.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And just also pointing out, like, over the overarching narrative of like acceleration versus deceleration is another narrative where, like, you know, people that are into Bitcoin and AI and technology want to push the world forward, while those that are anti-energy consumption want to push the world backward. And that's the overarching narrative that I think a lot of people can get behind, because people like living comfortable lives, and people like technology. Whether I think people gripe a lot about technology, but people like technology.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, wait. So let's change gears and talk about Craig Wright, because this is a really cool story. So Craig Wright, for those that don't know, this is called Fake Toshi. Okay, this guy has been, he has been, actually, I could probably get in trouble for that from him, because he's been suing.
Yeah, I was thinking about that.
He sues people for saying that he is not Satoshi. Luckily, we have the First Amendment in this country. That's not the case in many other countries. And so some people with who've been in countries that have, I suppose, more unjust speech regimes have been able to be sued by Craig Wright for saying that he's not Satoshi Nakamoto. So we're not going to get into whether he's Satoshi Nakamoto, but we'll just talk about how the evidence in this case has been laid out. So there's this organization called COPA, Crypto Open Patent Alliance. They were formed to challenge. Were they formed for this purpose? I think they were.
I believe so. Yeah.
They were formed to challenge Craig Wright's claim that to own the Bitcoin white paper, the copyright, I believe, and the patent. I don't know if he tried to patent it in the UK or something. And it's partially funded by Jack Dorsey and others. And in the course of this lawsuit, there have been multiple tranches of evidence that have been submitted to the court that have been sort of, I would say, it sounds to me from the news, it sounds like they were conclusively determined to be forgeries by the court. And so some of them really embarrassing, like one which he submitted, he didn't realize that he was showing an image of a tab that was open in his browser, and it showed that he was logged in as himself. And it, that kind of implied that he had generated the document on his own behalf, yeah, even though he said somebody else sent it. So it's kind of a mess. But for those who have been negatively affected by all of this litigation surrounding Craig Wright, I think it's a little bit of a relief to see the tide turning now, because up until now, it had not turned, and he was still getting a lot of traction. I had a friend send me last week, text me, who's like sort of peripheral to all this. He's not that into Bitcoin, but he's curious. And he was like, he sent me a Sun article, you know, that magazine, The Sun. And mm-hmm. it was like, court case may finally expose the true identity of Satoshi Nakamoto. That's how it was framed.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh my God, is this true? Like, is it over? Because it's like, you know, if Satoshi becomes like not anonymous, that could be an attack vector, right? Then there's a figurehead that you can attack. And so I had to like kind of explain the whole background. I mean, really lazy reporting from The Sun. I was very unhappy to see that article. Guys, please do better. But anyway, it's sort of good that it's finally turning the tide, and maybe this is the year that we can put this saga behind us.
Yeah, I would 100% agree. And also that this funnel toward like Bcash and BSV and all of these, like, basically, you know, Craig Wright associated altcoins, that like it, if you're like sucked into the Craig Wright Satoshi kind of that whole rabbit hole, then you could potentially end up believing in these other projects and allocating capital toward them. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that's been unfortunate to see, is these people like put a lot of their savings into these projects that we don't think are, you know, good uses of time, time and energy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're being very careful here.
We're being careful. You know, I don't know how careful we have to be, but let's just try to save ourselves the headache. So, okay. Next one is, okay, so this is interesting. So the SEC's SAB 121 custody rule changed. This is kind of technical, but I think it's important. David, do you want to explain how this works?
Yeah, so SAB 121 is a staff accounting bulletin. So it's not like an official rule that went through Congress, but the financial institutions treat it as if it were a rule, because that's how they work, right? They have to err on the side of caution, and that's kind of this fits within a broader change in how regulatory institutions have been putting in rules in place, which is basically rule by blog post, where they, you know, the SEC or the CFTC or some institution will basically release a blog post about their opinion or their guidance as related to something. Right. And then it's basically a way of that they can circumvent Congress, mm-hmm. and institute something. And that's what SAB 121 is, the staff accounting bulletin, which mandates that financial institutions record their customers' Bitcoin and crypto on their balance sheets, and then like also maintain a certain ratio of like capital to like back them. I'm assuming in case the volatility like drops the value of those assets, or something like that.
Right.
But the It's basically like if you and I were to become custodians, we would have to custody the assets, but then also have to maintain capital like against all of those assets. Mm-hmm. So it's basically made it unworkable for banks and other institutions to act as custodians, mm-hmm. because they have to take on all of these like additional capital reporting requirements and all of that. Hmm. And so the Government Accountability Office already last year said that the SEC should not have just basically dropped this without going through Congress. Hmm. But that doesn't change the fact that it's still out there, still exists. Everybody's still abiding by it. However, some bipartisan senators are, or congressional leaders have introduced a resolution to repeal it. Not sure if it's going to go through, but it has bipartisan support. And you would imagine that if it's repealed, institutions like BNY Mellon, for example, would potentially get into the custody game. And that would definitely unlock a lot of more institutional participation. Because I think that, like, you know, going back to BNY Mellon as an example, they're like they're the banks. They hold assets like four banks. This mm-hmm. is like their bread and butter. Yet they've basically been sidelined by regulatory measures from entering into the custody business. And if this were repealed, then you might see that change.
That's interesting. Yeah. So more integration with traditional financial companies.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think that, I mean, they were definitely, they were all very interested. Then FTX happened. Then they you know, changed their mind pretty quickly. But I think, at least from what we're hearing, there's definitely some appetite from these larger institutions to get into this arena. But there needs to be better rules, more clarity. And, you know, a lot of things need to happen on that front for them to do so.
Hmm. Okay. So then we have some Bitcoin adoption examples from this week. There's some interesting ones here. Okay. Let's just like go boom, boom, boom. Let's just go through them. Citra introduces a zero knowledge rollup to scale Bitcoin, enhancing block space without compromising security or decentralization. So what does that mean?
Yeah. So this is part of the this is part of the broader narrative of Bitcoin like layer two development and Bitcoin applications enabled by you know, new developments on Bitcoin that allow developers to create rollups and smart contracts and all sorts of stuff that we've seen on other blockchains, that they can do that on Bitcoin now. And there's been a lot of venture capital investment actually into these projects and companies that are doing this stuff. And it goes, you know, along with the narrative that, you know, things happen more slowly on Bitcoin, but that's because the security and is more important. And, you know, it's building that foundation slowly over time. And cool. This, yeah, and that's all I have without getting too into the weeds of Citra.
No, that's great. I think there's been a lot of renewed interest in layer two that is not Lightning. So like Lightning's still great, but I think for the last year and a half, it's been all Lightning all the time. And now we have sort of this Cambrian explosion of ideas and solutions for layer two. There's Arc, there's Liquid Bitcoin, there's Fediment, you know, tokens that are eCash created by Federated Cash Mints. There is this solution here. So a lot of talk again about multiple different layer twos, which is kind of exciting. Even a rediscussion about wrapped Bitcoin, which I don't know how I feel about that, but I saw that go by last night and I was like, wow, we're going there again. Okay. That's cool. But yeah, without getting into those details, we should talk about layer twos. We're going a bit long today, so let's table that. But I think we should do like a deep dive on layer twos because that's going to be really important this year. So another thing that caught my eye was there's a new solution we're going to shout out. We don't have any affiliation with these guys, but we're going to do a shout out to Sats Crap. So when I first saw this reported in our newsletter, I thought it was a typo. I thought it's like, that has to be Sats Cap, right? No, it's Sats Crap. But the idea is that you sell your crap you don't need to get sats, and you don't have to open a bank account. You don't have to have any kind of banking solution. You can just do a decentralized peer-to-peer Bitcoin transaction for auctions. So that's cool.
Yeah, very cool. It's kind of like eBay, but you know, if eBay wasn't using PayPal, if it was using Bitcoin and all of the benefits that brings.
Yeah. MicroStrategy bought 850 more Bitcoin, reaching 190,000, reinforcing its investment strategy. Bukele was reelected. So Nayib Bukele is the president of El Salvador. And that's very important to Bitcoin because he is sort of the head of state that is the most vocally in favor of Bitcoin and has made the most progress towards integrating Bitcoin with his government. Not perfect and not as fast as I anticipated it would go back when it was first announced. But you know, I think what's really important about this is that it didn't fail. Because everyone, you know, there were a lot of people in the United States that wanted it to fail. The media wanted it to fail. And then when Bitcoin was down during this bear market, there were just hundreds of media articles dunking on him and on his experiment with Bitcoin, because what would be better than taking out this populist leader who's trying to make a break from sort of being under the US umbrella with the dollarized economy, take him out and take out Bitcoin's viability as a legal tender currency. So they tried to do that, and I remember seeing a lot of media accounts of how there were these protesters in El Salvador who were against him and against Bitcoin. And maybe that's true. I'm not intimately familiar with Salvadorian society or anything like that. I'm sure there are people who are opposed to Bitcoin there, but it was really amplified out here. That's what we saw. And so to see him reelected by a historic margin, yes, he did a lot for crime, so I'm sure that was a big part of it, but he's also done a lot for the economy, and Bitcoin's part of that story. So I'm really excited to see if this gives him a mandate now to do even more with Bitcoin, then that could be really good.
Yeah, definitely. And I would encourage anybody to watch his inauguration video or speech that he posted on X. It's about half an hour long and really gives a really, yeah, it's this epic video. There's this huge crowd in front of the like palace or government building, and people are like blowing into I think they're called like vuvuzelas.
Vuvuzelas.
Yeah. It's like really just this loud, epic video.
Wow. Oh, that's cool. Yeah. I'll check it out.
Yeah.
Did he mention Bitcoin?
I think so. Yeah. It was mainly just a rebuke of kind of like, you know, I won again.
Type of thing. Yeah.
Like I won again. Shout out to my haters. Like, you know, very. Yeah. But it's good. It's definitely a victory lap, though.
That's cool. What do you think? Should we do how Bitcoin works in these, or should we just do CoinCheck? Because I was thinking about how Bitcoin works, but it's sort of like then you're just. Well, why don't we try it?
So yeah, sure.
Let me just explain. So we always write this little essay in our newsletter where we talk about some facet on Bitcoin or some angle on Bitcoin that maybe people hadn't thought of before. So we try to think of like ways that you can view what it is and how it's useful. And so this week we wrote Bitcoin is financial freedom. So David, what do we mean by that?
Yeah, so I think that a lot of, there's been a disconnect for a long time with respect to like money and freedom, and people definitely want financial freedom. They say they do. It's definitely like a thing that people talk about. People are opposed to CBDCs, but then a lot of people know the problem, but they don't necessarily know the solution. Mm-hmm. And we think that the solution is Bitcoin. And what we talk about here is how Bitcoin fits into that solution and solves that problem for financial freedom in a tangible way. It really like the product to the product that solves that unmet need in society.
Interesting. Yeah. And it's sort of like this, I think we were talking to when we were kind of gearing up to write this, that people do say they want freedom. And there is this element of having to take action and having to choose and having the responsibility of taking action and deciding what solution is the best. And so I think just in my perception, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but when I talk to people, I think that there's a little bit of a disconnect between what people say they want and what they're willing to do. And I can't fully explain that, but I've just noticed that, you know, the idea that Bitcoin even might be able to solve the problems that people are interested in solving is not enough for people to like get involved or even try it. And for me, that's just does not compute. Like, I don't know what's missing there. So, I mean, I think it's on us to do better, but at explaining the value. But I think it's incumbent sort of on every individual, as we believe strongly in individual freedom and liberty, that it really is incumbent on everybody to take responsibility for experimenting with solutions, for trying things, for keeping an open mind. If your goal is to live in freedom, then, you know, if somebody comes along and says, here's a technology that helps with that, there are millions, even over 100 million users by some estimations. It's legal, it's safe, it's something that you have to learn, but it can be learned. Definitely try to take that plunge. You know, get in, try something, you might lose your money. So just view that as a sunk cost, you know, buy $20 worth of Bitcoin and see how it works. If you lose $20, you know, that's no harm, no foul. And you'll have had an interesting experience, if nothing else. But I would encourage everybody to just take that first step. And if I may say so, Coinbits is designed for that first step. So if you guys are looking for a way to get started, I do get that question all the time. Like, okay, I do what? Like, I'm interested, but what do I do? So I would just send you to Coinbits. Yes, we work there, but it really is the easiest way. So go to coinbits.app and sign up for an account, and you can have your first Bitcoin in a few minutes.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so getting into the coin checks, how many times has Bitcoin been hard forked? Over 50 times, two, over 100 times, three, over 70 times, four, exactly 70 times. And should we read the answer?
Yeah.
Okay. So the answer is over 100 times. Bitcoin has undergone over 100 hard forks throughout its history. And this was actually inspired by the COPPA trial with, you know, Craig Wright and BSV and Bitcoin Cash and all of these different versions of Bitcoin. Most of the different hard forks have basically fizzled out. Bitcoin Cash and I think there's like Bitcoin Gold or something. Maintain like a small user base, but that's, you know, nobody has been able to overcome Bitcoin's network effects.
Yeah. So, and just real fast, so a network effect, it's like, and we have a diagram, but when you join a network, the number of connections that you're able to make with other people depends on how many others are on the network. It sounds sort of like a no-brainer, but for something where you're exchanging data or money, value, in the case of Bitcoin, it's very important that you have options, right? When money is the most saleable good in an economy, which means it's the most able to be traded for other things. So in order for that to be true of any kind of money, you need to have many, many, many participants in that network so that you are able to trade with them. And so the size of the user base of a cryptocurrency helps you understand how useful it is. And something that I think gets lost in sort of these lists of tickers, you know, where you go to like Coinbase and you see all these different cryptocurrencies and they all have a little three-letter code and a name and an icon. They all look like they're sort of on the same playing field. Like, oh, there's all these options. There's like this one and that one, and there's Bitcoin. And like, what you don't get from that view is the tremendous size and scale difference that we're talking about. It's like they're not even on the same planet. Like Bitcoin is by and like large, like it's used across the planet. It's recognized by hundreds of millions of people across the planet. And those, that network has now been established in the early days of Bitcoin. Could another cryptocurrency have overtaken it? Like maybe, but not anymore. So you really have to kind of understand that that's a, there's a, an enormous chasm between Bitcoin and everything else.
Yeah. And I think that that is a wonderful place to wrap this first week on.
Excellent. All right. Thank you, David. Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.